there is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws. This is Universal's extraordinary motion picture version of Peter Benchley's best-selling novel, Jaws.
I just found out that a girl got killed here last week, and you knew it. You knew there was a shark out there. You knew it was dangerous, but you let people go swimming anyway.
It's all psychological. You yell barracuda. Everybody says, huh?
What?
You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
Is it true that most people get attacked by sharks in 3 feet of water, about 10 feet from the beach?
Yeah.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine. An eating machine.
We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
Bad fish. But I'll catch him and kill him.
Did you hear your father? Out of the water now!
This shark, swallow you whole.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
That's a 20-footer.
25. 3 tons of them.
He's coming straight for us. Don't screw it up now.
Don't wait for me. Now! Shoot!
None of man's fantasies of evil can compare with the reality of Jaws. Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, Jaws. See it before you go swimming.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this week, just in time for the 4th of July, we are going to be discussing the 1975 classic Jaws, directed by, of course, Steven Spielberg, starring Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, and Robert Shaw. As you might guess, Jaws is one of my all-time favorite movies. It's right there in the show logo. So along with me to discuss this wonderful, wonderful film, we've got our very own Matt Hooper, marine science and conservation consultant, blogger for SouthernFrightScience.com, and longtime friend of the Aquaman Shrine, Andrew David Thaler. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, thank you. I'm super thrilled about this. This is really, really exciting for me. So before we get into the science part of this movie, and there is a lot to discuss on that end, let's just talk about the movie itself, Jaws. When did you first see this movie? Did you see it in the theaters?
I did not see it in the theaters. I'm a little young for that.
Me too.
But I probably saw it when I was about 8.
That's pretty young to see this movie.
It was, I'm pretty sure I probably had some nightmares for a day or two. But then, you know, it's a fantastic movie and you kind of fall in love with the shark, really.
Well, I think some of us fell in love with the shark. I mean, yeah, there is not a whole point in getting into the plot because everyone knows it. And in terms of this is one of the most, I'd say, cataloged movies in terms of everyone knows the background behind it and how difficult a shoot it was. The shark was never working. And so that forced Spielberg to have to, you know, rely on suggestion. And, of course, that iconic theme by John Williams, the dum-dum-dum-dum, which is just in, you know –
It's amazing what two notes can do to your entire emotional state.
Yeah, I mean, there's the famous story about that when John Williams first played it for Spielberg, Spielberg said, oh, that's funny. Okay, what's the real theme? That's not really the theme, is it? And, of course, it was the theme. And, you know, just a couple of years later, it became so iconic. They use it in Caddyshack, for Pete's sake, just a couple of years later in a gag scene about a shark. So it's one of those movies that's just – everything went wrong, and yet everything went right because, you know, Spielberg wanted to cast Lee Marvin in the role of Quint, and he couldn't get Lee Marvin. And then he tried to get Sterling Hayden. He couldn't get Sterling Hayden. And he ended up going with Robert Shaw. And, of course, I can't imagine anybody being better at Quint than Robert Shaw in this movie. Or, you know, apparently originally Charlton Heston was interested and wanted to play Brody, and Spielberg flatly turned him down and said, nobody is going to believe the shark is going to win if Charlton Heston's the guy on the boat. And, of course, he was completely right about that. Roy Scheider was perfect. Richard Dreyfuss, perfect. I mean, just all down the line, this movie is just perfect in every way. And this is just one of those movies that, even though I have other movies that I would say are slightly more important to me in terms of my life, Jaws is a movie that if I knew I could never see it again, it would make me very upset. You know,
yeah, I mean, Jaws, it really is. It's a perfect film. It's hard to top, and that's part of, in the marine conservation world, part of the problem with Jaws is that it's such a perfect film. Like, no one has lasting shark phobia about Deep Blue Sea, and there's a very good reason for that. Deep Blue Sea was a terrible movie and evoked no emotions in people.
Right, yeah, it's all the computer-generated sharks and stuff. Yeah, I mean, this thing, I think, like you, I was a little young to see it in its first theatrical run, but I know I saw it in the theater because I remember sitting next to my father and watching Quint getting munched, and it still is one of the – it's funny. For a movie that gets so much mileage out of not showing the shark, when it does show the shark in a very explicit way, and in some people would argue in a cartoony way almost, when he's sitting there munching on Quint, it is one of the most horrific sequences to me in all of movies. And even though I've seen it 1,000 times, it's still so painful to watch, I guess, with how long it takes. I mean, it really takes Quint a long time to get eaten. It's not 2 seconds. I mean, he's conscious of getting munched, but we're getting way ahead of ourselves because that's the end of this movie. I mean, like, why, other than it being a classic, I mean, why do you love it so much?
You know, so I've been thinking a bit about Jaws because you asked me to come on this a couple weeks ago now, and I've been preparing for a talk at a science communications conference in a couple of weeks, and I've been thinking about Joseph Campbell's monomyth and kind of the heroic epic. And then, you know, that classic storyline that all really iconic storytelling is kind of framed around. And I realized something very interesting while thinking about Jaws and the monomyth, and that the shark has a heroic arc too. It goes through that same process. It slays its dragon at the climax as well. And then, of course, it's killed by the other two. But, you know, that sort of every character has their own kind of perfect arc from the moment you meet them to the moment they go away. And I think that just – that resonates in a way that very few other movies ever do. And then, of course, I just love sharks. I mean, anytime – I love Deep Blue Sea even though it's a terrible movie because there's sharks in it. I love Sharknado because it's sharks and they're in a tornado. Neither of those are great movies, but they have sharks in it, so I'll give it a pass.
It says something about that they've made, you know, they've been making shark movies for 40 years and no one's been able to get even close to this. I mean, I haven't seen The Shallows yet. Supposedly that's not too bad. And I kind of want to see it just because I would like to see another good shark movie. But they've just never been able to get close to this. And I think you're absolutely right about it in terms of the arc of all these characters. I mean, first of all, you've got these three wonderful characters. They are the perfect triangle of characters. I mean, they are Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, on a boat, because you've got the guy who is just super passionate and is just kill shark, kill shark, kill shark. You've got the brainy guy who is appreciating them on a scientific level, which I'm picturing you out there on the prow of the boat yelling at somebody, I need to give it some scale. You're like, get the hell out of here, Andrew. I'm not doing that. And then, of course, you've got Brody, who is the ultimate everyman. I mean, it seems like he probably had his fill of crime in New York. I guess he retired from being a cop in the French Connection, and now he's moved over to Amityville. He's moved over to Amity, and he kind of wants an easy life. And if that's what he's getting, I mean, he mentions in 25 years there's never been a shooting or a murder in this town. And now he's dealt with he has this problem in front of him that is just unbelievable. Yeah. And, you know, yeah, I mean, even she doesn't get an arc, but like I think about Ellen Brody, how she gets a nice final scene. You know, yeah. When in so many movies where the wife of the hero is the one who's, you don't do it. You can't go out there. You've got children. You know, you don't get any of those scenes from her. She, you know, we don't know exactly how she feels about him going out on the shore. I'm sure she's not happy about it. And the final scene where she runs off to the pier in tears, it's like, that's a great final moment where you're like, she is just so overwhelmed with the emotion of she might never see her husband again. And it's just every, I think most horror movies don't bother with that and don't bother with giving a good sense of place. And this movie is just filled to the brim with a sense of place. I mean, Amity is one of the most fully realized settings for a movie I can think of.
It's fantastic how well they put it all together. And I mean, you say, you know, I might be the Brody, but I connect most a little bit with the mayor just because I really want a suit just covered in anchors.
Everybody wants that suit.
Just you see him walk out in that suit and you're like, I know exactly who this guy is.
He is great. Yeah, that guy was absolutely perfect. Murray Hamilton as Mayor Vaughn. I mean, the line about we had some trouble, which we caught a large predator, which supposedly injured some bathers. Supposedly injured some bathers. He ate a child. What are you talking about? Like the perfect politician with the doublespeak and the nonsense. I mean, it's like imagine if Jaws took place on the internet. How many gifts there would be of this guy made of supposedly injured some bathers. I mean, the fact that he gets away with saying that is just unbelievable. Yeah, it is. I mean, even the guy that Carl Gottlieb plays, the screenwriter Carl Gottlieb plays, I forget his character name, but like he's like just like in Meadows. He's just like this little guy off to the side. He only has, I think, about 5 or 6 lines, but he gets the bit about where he's going to bury Miss Kintner's ad so far back in the paper. It's going to be with the Field and it's going to be in Field and Stream. It's going to be with the supermarket ads. I mean, you've got this guy fighting to keep this, you know, localized and keep this from becoming a problem. Then you've got that wonderful woman who was one of the islanders, one of the locals, you know, where she's like, I don't think that's funny. That's not funny at all. You know, like she only gets like 2 lines, but she's so memorable. It's a horror movie with, I just feel like, again, the screenplay is just so well done. And in terms of the pacing, yeah. I mean, this movie fits so perfectly in that the first hour is a horror movie and then it becomes a men's adventure movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And you never see – I mean, the thing that makes it work so well is how rarely you see the shark. And, of course, that's because the animatronic shark was just the worst thing ever.
Right. Yeah, Richard Dreyfuss has done 1,000 interviews. But I saw him on an interview program with Bob Costas called Later, which used to be on in the 90s. And he used to talk about that they would do these scenes and they would get all their lines right, wait for the shark, and then the shark would come out and go like, yeah, 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 like just – mouth a bunch of nonsense, and he didn't look threatening at all, and they were like cut. So it's like, as he said, he didn't want to do this movie. This was a movie that he would rather watch than shoot because he knew how difficult it was going to be to make, but of course he ended up doing it because he had seen himself in another movie, The Apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz, and thought he was so awful in it that he's like, I better get another job, so I'll take this shark movie. I mean, again, it's one of those things where everything went wrong and yet it all fell together so perfectly. Now, so in terms of the characters, I mean, when you saw Hooper, was that something where like, I want to be that guy?
I probably first saw it before I was in that whole, I want to be a marine biologist mindset. So I never really remember connecting with Hooper like I connected with, I mean, really, I connected with Quint. I've been a fisherman all my life, and you know, he was kind of more my kind of person for a while, until it took a little bit more education, and I had to go to school for a lot longer before I realized what I wanted to be and what I wanted to do with my life. So I don't know if Hooper was really who I connected with when I first saw that movie.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, Quint is one of those guys that it's like you would love to hang out with him, but he's also terrifying.
He's a classic, just grizzled old salt that knows exactly who he is and accepts no limitations, and is just a giant asshole at the end of it.
I mean, the movie even sort of comments on about where he's like yelling out in the background, and Brody says to Mrs. Brody, "Colorful, isn't he?" Which almost feels like the movie is saying, yeah, we know this guy is an outsized personality. I mean, of course, one of the great introductions in all of film, of scratching the chalkboard with his fingernails. I mean, and that slow push-in on him is just – and he just has – I mean, of course, and he has the later monologue about being on the Indianapolis, which is one of the great scenes of cinema. And again, a scene that fell together kind of out of nowhere because it was apparently the work of three different writers, and then it was Robert Shaw rewriting what the writers rewrote, and yet he turned it in because originally it was something like 10 pages. Right. And he's like, I can't do 10 pages, and he boiled it down to like 3 pages. And now it's, you know, for as exciting as Jaws is, the movie stops dead cold for that scene, and it is so scintillating. I mean, you envision it in your head of him talking about it, you know?
Oh, it's incredible. And it's this perfect moment of, like, you don't need to animate it or illustrate it in any way. It's just – it's a man sitting in the galley of a boat talking, and it's still just so compelling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's – yeah. The music is perfect behind it, and the fact that the other two guys are silent and they just listen to this story. And, you know, when I grew up – when I first – you know, I didn't know that that was a real thing. I was that age, I didn't care either way. But I it wasn't until later that I knew that that was a real event, which is, you know, of course, even more terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have – like, are there any particular favorite scenes you have of Jaws? I mean, the whole thing is so perfect, but, I mean, there are certain moments, of course, that everybody loves.
I mean, you know, it's going to sound weird coming from a marine biologist, but the scene I just can never forget is, that's some bad hat, Harry.
The guy with like, those just, very upsetting breasts.
It's just a perfect, it's not really, I mean, it sets up a little bit about the characters, but it's a perfect character, like, little moment that, like, defines the character of the town. It doesn't add anything to the plot, but it's just this fun, beautiful moment where you're like, all right, I kind of know what this Brody guy's about now.
Yeah, I mean, he's as Ellen Brody says, you know, you are uptight, which you can only imagine because – and, of course, it's got that wonderful push in, the combination – it's like a pan out and a zoom in.
Yeah.
Or something like that, which was done by Hitchcock in reverse in Vertigo. But in Jaws, it just is so beautiful and disorienting at the same time. About, you know, that the wipes on and off of people are going back and forth. I mean, this is – again, it's – you know, we all know now Steven Spielberg, you know, one of the great masters of cinema. But for this guy to be 25 and to have this much command of his art form is unbelievable. He only had one film to his credit, and he did some TV stuff. But he only had one film to his credit before this. And, you know, it says something about, for once, you know, something nice about movie studio executives – that they saw how talented this guy was early on. There's a story about that when he shot the pilot, or one of the stories for the pilot for Night Gallery, which was in, I think, 1969 or 1970, and that featured Joan Crawford. And Joan Crawford apparently didn't cotton to Steven Spielberg, didn't think he was particularly intelligent, and called the studio to complain about him. And the studio basically told Joan Crawford, go pound sand. We think this kid is talented. And, of course, they were right. And it's, you know, movie studio executives are so easy to, you know, make fun of and be like, oh, they're just a bunch of suits. But they recognize how good this guy was. And, boy, did that pay off, because it is astonishing how assured a directorial hand is on this film. I mean, it's there are just so many moments where you realize it could be done wrong, and you can't have a better example of how it could be done wrong that there are three successive Jaws films that get them all wrong. I mean,
oh man, there's more than three though.
Well, I mean, Jaws, literally Jaws movies.
Yeah. Because there's a Jaws 3 and a Jaws 3D.
Well, that's the same movie, though.
Is it?
Yeah, it's the same movie.
Oh.
Yeah.
So I have only seen Jaws 4 of the And the reason I've seen Jaws 4 is because I was in Best Buy, and I looked over into their bargain DVD bin, and there was a Jaws DVD. And it was like the normal Jaws shark coming out of the ocean cover. And it was marked 99 cents. And I was like, oh, this is great. This was before Netflix and before we could stream everything. I'm like, oh, great. You know, I'll pay a buck for Jaws. That's perfect. I'd pay more than a buck for Jaws, but it was there. I grab it, I take it home, and I realize someone had put the price tag right over the 4.
Good move, Best Buy.
So I was like, all right, well, I guess I have to watch it. And I think it was – was it 4 or 3? It was the one where the Jaws – it was like a mama Jaws in an aquarium.
That's Jaws 3.
Okay. Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, they're all – I've seen every one of them in the theater. I mean, I remember seeing Jaws 2 and being scared of it. But when you watch it again, it's much more prosaic horror movie. There's just big shots of the shark coming out of the water and just chomping people. And, you know, for a cheap Jack horror movie – it works just fine for that. I mean, you feel bad for Roy Scheider. He looks just so adrift in this movie. I mean, he was forced to do it by the studio. But, I mean, you can't have a better example of how easily wrong this movie could have gone than you have literally three movies that follow it that are horrible. I mean, you just this movie – and, you know, I don't know about you, but, like, bad sequels don't necessarily ruin a movie for me. I can able – in my mind, I can just sort of bifurcate and say, well, yeah, those are the later movies. Those suck. This Jaws does not get it. Like, when Jaws ends with the shot of the two of them on the beach, I want the story to continue.
Yeah.
I want to keep fighting, even though technically it does, because you get to see Roy Scheider again having to – we got to close the beaches again in Jaws 2. I just forget them all. I just forget those movies exist.
Well, that's the thing. They're not movies that even stick with you past seeing them. Like, you leave the theater and you're like, I mean, I guess I saw a movie. That was a thing, right?
Yeah.
I lost 2 hours of time.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, it's funny that, you know, Hooper was originally supposed to die in Jaws. And the only reason he didn't is because the real life shark footage shot by, I think the Taylors were the couple that they hired to do this, literally couldn't get a shot of the dummy that they had made to put in the cage of the shark. And so they had to retrofit the screenplay for Hooper to live. And it's another one of those dumb mistakes that makes the movie better. Because to me, Jaws, even though Quint gets it, that's...
But Quint should get it.
Should
like,
get it,
it
exactly.
All leads up to Quint should get it.
Yeah. And it's like, to me, if Hooper had died, the movie would be depressing. It would be, even though Brody lives, the movie would have been a depressing ending if Hooper died too. So the fact that Hooper lives by accident... You're like, again, this movie fell into itself of how perfect it is, because it is wonderful to watch them swim off on those rafts together. Yeah. And even though Brody still says, you know, the tide's still with us, and Hooper's like, keep kicking. Like, even he's like, just look, I know you don't want the water, but we're going to make it home. I mean, it is remarkable how many things – I know I keep going back to this, but it's like how many things could have gone wrong, and yet it ends up making the movie better. And that is just – remarkable. It's just such serendipity. And in terms of my favorite scene, I mean, you talk about the Bad Hat Harry, which clearly was director Brian Singer's favorite scene, because he named his production company Bad Hat Harry Productions.
Studios. Yeah.
I mean, in a weird way, my favorite scene is when Chief Brody is looking at the book, the Time Life book about sharks.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, he's looking at the picture and he yells at his son to get out of the boat. And Ellen Brody is like, you know, what are you doing? He's not in the water. He's in a boat. And she says, okay. And then they back down. And then she sees that wonderful illustration of a shark ripping a boat in two. And then she yells, Michael, did you hear your father? Get out of the water now. Now! And and they hang on Chief Brody as he looks baffled. He's like, wait, why did my wife just change her mind? I just love that little character beat of that, okay, Ellen's on board now. She now sees exactly how dangerous this is. And then I think, I mean, God, it's all great scenes. But my other favorite scene is when it's Brody and Hooper on the boat at night, which is crazy. When Hooper's like, we're going to go out on the water. What are you, crazy, Hooper? What's the matter with you? But when they're talking about the cameras And he says, you know, who pays for this stuff? This stuff's expensive. And he says, oh, I paid for it, actually. And Brody, who's drunk, is like, what are you, rich? And Hooper's, yeah. Really? How much? And he says, me or the whole family? And, like, to me, I'm like, that made me want to see a whole side movie of Matt Hooper on the Aurora. You know, like, the yeah. Matt Hooper adventure movie. I didn't want to follow Brody, not as much as I love Brody, but it's like, it's the same story. I want to follow Matt Hooper chasing sharks. That's a whole, that's a movie I would pay to see. Yeah.
Well, you don't have to pay to see those movies. You can see them in real life. You can follow labs like Neil Hammerschlag's and Chris Fisher's, which are out doing shark tagging every day and streaming a lot of it online.
That is amazing. Well, that's the perfect that is the perfect segue to talk about, because again, there's so much to say about Jaws, but you know, we could just spend all 2 hours just talking about great scenes. But that's a perfect segue to talk about your work. Now, what is it exactly for anyone who doesn't follow SouthernFriedScience.com or follow you on Twitter, which is at Andrew David Thaler? Like, explain to people what you do.
So I'm actually a deep sea ecologist. So I don't work with sharks, though I do a lot of conservation work with shark messaging. What I do is I look at hydrothermal vent ecosystems in the Pacific and figure out how human impacts are going to affect and change these systems that are really – they're so far away and so alien to anything we know or understand or have in kind of our general consciousness that no one really ever thinks about them. But they're basically underwater volcanoes that these like just massive ecosystems form around that are just totally weird alien life forms. They're utterly fascinating, utterly bizarre, and just so distant and so out of most people's frame of reference that they are just challenging to get people to understand. And so that's what I work on, and I do a lot of my work out in Papua New Guinea.
Wow.
Yeah.
I heard this metaphor once many years ago, and it always stuck with me, and you can disabuse me of it if it's not true. But someone I can't remember where I read this, but someone said the equivalent knowledge to what we know about what's under this water is the equivalent to that is flying a plane with a net behind it and scooping up whatever you could in an hour, and that would represent what we know about planet Earth. Like that tiny a sample, that's how little we know about the oceans. Is that accurate?
I'd say that probably gives an inflated estimate of how much we know
wow.
about the ocean.
Okay.
Because if you think about it, you've got the total global biosphere, all of the parts of the world capable of supporting life. And on the surface, you've got about half a mile, really, up to you've got the surface of the Earth, and you can get up to about 10,000 feet, and that's when you really don't see a lot of life being supported. So 2 miles. And that's 30% of the surface of the Earth. And then you go down into the ocean, and the ocean goes down 11,000 meters to the bottom of Challenger Deep. 98% of the total Earth's biosphere is in the ocean. Only 2% is land and air.
Wow.
So we really have a lot of work left to do in terms of studying and understanding the ocean.
What inspired you to do this kind of work? I mean, you said you've been a fisherman your whole life, but I mean, that's a far cry from wanting to necessarily do it as a living.
Yeah, so I guess in high school I started an internship at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, and that's really where I kind of cut my teeth in the marine science world. I spent 3 years working in the Cygnathid breeding program. Cygnathids are seahorses. So I was basically a janitor and a plumber for a while, maintaining the tank systems, keeping the filters clean, changing out filters, feeding the fish. And through that, I eventually kind of climbed higher and higher up the ladder and eventually ended up as an assistant aquarist, where I was actually taking care of the animals and designing my own experiments. And that's really probably where I got my start. Before then, I was always a tremendous lover of fishes. So I'd have hundreds of gallons of fish tanks in my room, to the point where my parents made me get rid of them because the my bedroom was on the second floor, and the floor was actually bowing underneath the weight of all these fish tanks. So they're like, the house is going to collapse. You're not allowed to have any more fish.
Wow. I mean, what is there – like for someone who has never owned fish as pets, I've had pets my whole life, but I've never owned fish. Like, can you explain a little bit like what the connection is necessarily? Do you have an emotional connection to owning fish? I mean, because it's like they seem so unresponsive in terms of being
absolutely.
A pet.
And it's it's such a connection that I can't own fish now because I know too much. The tropical fish trade is actually really, really destructive to the ocean.
I would bet, yeah.
Kind of the Finding Nemo problem that we have going on, and I'm sure we'll start calling it the Finding Dory problem this summer. But fish have personalities. They're very, very charismatic, and if you have a lot of them in a nice balanced aquarium where you can really kind of see them interact, you've got like multiple species, you've got a nice little ecosystem, it's relatively natural. You can actually start seeing individual personalities and individual behaviors, and you can kind of watch them and sort of understand what they're doing, and you definitely do develop an emotional connection with them. Not quite like you do with a dog or a cat, but you certainly come to understand them as individuals and kind of see how they interact with each other and find cool behaviors and see what's going on and discover weird things. Because one of the big things with tropical fish tanks is oftentimes you get more than you bargained for, especially if you bring in corals or anything. One of my favorite stories is I had a buddy, he works at the Georgia Aquarium now, but he had a really, really nice tropical fish tank set up, and he had a bunch of very, very expensive fish in it, and they started disappearing. He added some new coral 1 week, and the next week some of his fish were gone. And the week after that, a few more of his fish were gone. And the week after that, a few more of his fish were gone. So he's like, all right, I got to figure out what's going on. He took all of the fish out of it, put them in a new tank, drained the tank, and discovered it's called a bobbit worm. And it's called a bobbit worm for the exact reason you think it's called a bobbit worm.
Oh, no.
It is this polychaete worm. It's a Eunice. I don't know the specific name, but the genus is Eunice. And it... they get long. They can get several meters long. They burrow down under the sand, and they have these amazing big switchblade jaws, and they just kind of lie in wait, and if something gets near them, and they can take out a whole, like a big fish, not like a little tiny tetra or anything, but they can take out like a big Oscar or a big tropical reef fish, and they just, the jaw slams shut, and they just yank these fish down underneath the sand and disappear, and you'll never know they're there unless you drain the tank and dig out all the sand.
Yikes. Where did it come? Did it just come with the tank and nobody knew it?
There must have been a very, very small bobbit worm in with a new batch of coral that he had introduced.
Oh, wow.
And it just grew and it grew and then it was big.
Oh, that's terrifying. That's, yeah.
It is. If you Google pictures of it, it's a beautiful animal too. Like, it's got some iridescent color to it. The jaws just look magnificent. Speaking of jaws, there are far more invertebrates in the ocean that terrify me than any shark out there.
That's interesting. Now, in terms of the sharks, again, I know nothing about sharks other than what I know from these movies and from reading Peter Benchley's book, Shark Trouble. Ironically enough, that he himself, when he wrote this book, he had no idea. Of course, he had no idea. Nobody could have guessed that this thing would become a global cultural phenomenon. And unfortunately, sharks really. I don't mean to use a pun and try and make light of it, but sharks really took a beating after Jaws. I read some stories today about some of the things that were done by people, idiots out there, in terms of to whales and to dolphins in the light of Jaws' release, because people didn't thought they were sharks or whatever. But like, and he himself felt guilty about that. He himself was like, he didn't like the idea, because he's loved shark. He loved sharks his whole, he's no longer with us. He loved sharks his whole life, and he felt guilty that he forever painted them with this brush of these merciless killers that need to be destroyed out of the ocean. And so he wrote this book, Shark Trouble, which – and there's an audio version which he himself narrates, and I've listened to it, I don't know, probably half a dozen times. It's a nonfiction book, and it's stories about sharks. And I find it a really beautiful book, because I feel like it's his sort of wanting to give back a little, to say, geez, I'm sorry, sharks. And there he tells a great story about, sharks are – specifically, is it apex predators? Is that the right term?
Apex predators.
Apex predators. And it's like, you can't get rid of them without screwing up the ecosystem. because they serve a distinct purpose. And the idea that we should go out there and hunt them down because they might kill us while we're in their turf is completely ridiculous. And of course, I mean, you know, Benchley couldn't have known. I mean, his book was a bestseller. He couldn't have known that Spielberg was going to turn it into what he turned it into. Right. And of course, that's worth a whole discussion too about the book versus the movie, because the book gets bogged down with all sorts of details that Spielberg thankfully jettisoned: the affair between Hooper and Mrs. Brody, and the whole mob angle, and all this stuff about real estate, and he ditches all stuff. Mm.
And of course, the book was set on the Jersey Shore, which,
right.
I mean, let's be honest, if it was sharks versus the cast of the Jersey Shore, I think we'd all be on the other side.
Yay, sharks! Yay! I mean, now, in terms of the shark's behavior, like, is what in the movie, what about, other than the shark literally leaping onto the boat at the end of the movie, is there anything in the movie that the shark, that you would be like, sharks just can't do that, or that's completely out of bounds?
I mean, other than the fact that sharks haven't gotten as big as that shark is for about 10 million years.
Okay.
And obviously some of them more dramatic, them leaping out of the boat. Sharks really don't care about people. Sharks actually occasionally will, great whites will, lunge out of the sea to grab seals on the beach. So they can't do that.
Oh, that's right.
That kind of thing can happen.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Sharks don't, people don't really look like food. Sharks don't have a frame of reference. And they don't really care about us at all. You know, if a human accidentally looks like a piece of food, a shark might take a bite. And usually what happens, a lot of what people think are shark attacks, where it's not like a clear bite, but it's more of an abrasion, okay, is the shark making a taste test. Sharks, like, they don't – like, they have a lot of sensory apparatus in their noses. They have very, very rough skin. And if they want to see if something is food, they'll often bump up against it, cause a small wound, and then they can smell from the water whether or not it's food or just some dude hanging out in board shorts. and most of the time, like, most shark attacks aren't actually bites. They're bumps. And it just happens once because they bump you. They're like, eh, that's nothing. And they move on with their lives. Of course, you know, a great white shark taking a taste of someone to determine if it's food or not could still be fatal for that someone.
Of course.
So that's not to downplay the fact that sharks do occasionally attack people, and they can, you know, it's like any other time where you're interacting with a big animal. Big animals can hurt you. If you mess around with a cow can kill you too. That doesn't mean the cows are coming after us.
And Steven Spielberg's Moo.
That would actually probably be an amazing movie. But in terms of what sharks can actually do, like you said, they had a really hard time even getting the sharks to attack a dummy in a shark cage. And that's because sharks just don't care about people that much. Like, we're weird alien things that shouldn't be in their environment. And so they don't have a frame of reference for us. So they're not like, there's no immediate signal to them like, oh, that's a food thing, or oh, that's a danger thing.
Okay. Because they naturally eat seals and other things, and we just don't look like a seal to them. Is that,
we don't look like a seal, and more importantly, we don't smell like a seal.
Well, smell, of course. Yeah, that's there. Now, you talk about the abrasions. Is that because the shark's skin is incredibly rough? Is that true?
Yeah. So shark skin is teeth. Is kind of the easiest way to summarize it. Shark skin is what's called a dermal denticle. So it is a tiny calcareous tooth that is arrayed like a. So they're scales, but they're made of the same stuff their teeth are made of, and if you rub them in one direction, they're smooth as silk. And if you rub them in the other direction, they are the roughest sandpaper you've ever felt.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. All right. So a lot of shark biologist friends of mine, they get shark burns because they're tagging a shark, they're doing a workup, they're taking blood samples, they have to hold the shark down. And if it thrashes, they're going to get a lot of abrasions on them. So shark burn is a thing that happens to shark scientists quite a bit.
Wow. That's, oh boy. So yeah, so I mean, in the second half of the movie, clearly Bruce the shark is out to get these three guys, because after they stick him with the barrels, which again became an incredibly easily and cost effective way of having the shark in the movie without having to show the shark. Hey, oh, yeah. The barrels are there. That means the shark's around. But that shark does not give up. Once he gets a wind of our three heroes, he's there for the long haul. I mean, to the point, again, where he leaps onto the end of the boat to kill them all. So you're saying that part, like a shark would not, if you've harpooned a shark, he would just go away at that point. He would just be like, that's it.
So we like to anthropomorphize animals and think that they kind of think like us. And you're like, oh yeah, the shark's going to be out for revenge because we hurt it. And, you know, people like to get revenge because we feel self-righteous and it feels vindictive. But a shark's going to be like, this is a thing that causes pain. I'm going to get as far away from it as possible and never interact with it again.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Now, do sharks go after prey that are like equal to it to itself? Or they go after seals, which are presumably much easier targets?
I mean, the biggest example of that would be probably great white sharks versus orcas. And they'll go after young orcas and they'll go after sick orcas. Hmm. But in general, orcas are also apex predators. Generally, they'll give each other a wide berth. And in an adult orca versus an adult great white shark, the great white shark's coming out the wrong end of that deal.
I think that's part of the thing. I'm looking at the poster here as we're talking. I mean, one of the great movie posters of all time. I have it as my my wallpaper from my phone, and I use it. It's even my icon for my my Skype handle here. I mean, first of all, I mean, there is no shark that big, you know.
That's alive today.
That's alive today. Okay, all right. Well, that's perfect. Let me ask you about that then. Why is that? Why was there sharks that big long ago and not now?
So there were Carcharocles megalodon was the biggest shark, and they went extinct about 10 million years ago, probably due to a combination of environmental changes and changes in food supply and other animals filling biologic niches. I mean, there's no reason why they're not around today other than I don't know exactly why megalodon went extinct. Okay. I'm sure there are some better researchers in the shark world that have hypotheses about that. But there are apex predators in the ocean that get that big. I mean, orcas are a great example.
Right,
And in some ways, orcas have kind of just filled that ecologic niche, so there's no space for a giant shark to take up occupation. It would be outcompeted. Sperm whales are predators as well, and they are massive. You definitely don't want to mess with a sperm whale. And they'll take out – I mean, they go mostly after invertebrates and squids and stuff like that. So they're not – you know, sperm whales are not prowling the beaches looking for seals.
right.
But orcas certainly do occupy very similar ecologic niches to some of the bigger sharks from the past. Hmm. And a lot of it could have just been the ocean lost the ability to support biomass that big for a while. You know, if there were an extinction event, even a localized extinction event, where suddenly an ocean was less productive than it was before, the first thing that's going to go is the giant apex predators because they require the most food to sustain themselves.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. In Jaws 2, Marvel Comics did an adaptation of it in a magazine form, and I have it, and it's drawn by Gene Colan and Tom Palmer, two really great comic book artists. But Gene Colan definitely took, like, the Marvel license, because there's a scene where the shark jumps out of the water, and it's, like, the size of a Star Destroyer. I mean, like, I'm like, you know, like, that's the – if that really happened in real life, no one's ever going in the water ever again, because the thing is the size of, like, Rhode Island. It's like, okay, even the movie couldn't get anything that massive. But, I mean, now, like, you mentioned that whales don't come by and – like, is that because humans just have not interacted with whales, that they are not, to most people, inherently terrifying? I mean, Star Trek 4, we got to save the whales. That's a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
We got to save them. But you look at a shark and people are like inherently like, do you think a lot of it is just this movie and it's the painting and people, when people think of a shark, they think Jaws, and that's just, it's so primal that they can't separate the two.
So I hear a lot of people in the shark conservation world talking about the Jaws effect and how Jaws kind of changed the way we relate to sharks and made people fear them in a much more visceral way. And I'm not convinced. You know, I think it's too convenient a story. I think part of what made Jaws so compelling is that we were already very, very afraid of sharks. We've been running a kind of a complement and alternative to Shark Week called Jacques Week, where we watch classic Jacques Cousteau documentaries. And last night we did The Silent World, which was Jacques Cousteau's first film from 1954. And there's a scene in The Silent World where Jacques Cousteau, who's of course this paragon, this icon of ocean documentaries and this kind of hero of the marine conservation movement. This is early in his career before conservation was really his focus. But there's a part where he's like, they're about to go diving and there's sharks in the water. And he's like, all seamen fear the shark. He is their natural enemy. And then they go and they just murder like 200 sharks. And there's this scene of Cousteau and his crew hauling sharks onto his deck and beating them with whatever object they have available. They've got bats and axes.
Oh.
And, yeah. It's a brutal scene. It was really hard to watch. I picked that movie for Jacques Week because I wanted a little bit of a historic context to help people see that there's, you know, people don't immediately start as heroes of conservation. There's an evolution that happens as you learn more. But this is Jacques Cousteau, and even Jacques is like, we hate sharks, we have to kill them all. So,
wow.
And, you know, 20, 25 years before Jaws. So that mentality was there. That mentality was deeply embedded in our psyche long before Jaws came around. I think Jaws brought it to the surface, and all my puns are always intentional. But but I think that, you know, Jaws was feeding off of something that was already there in our society. I think the more interesting Jaws effect is it really pushed sharks over the top to the point the pushback against Jaws kind of led to this modern shark conservation ethic where sharks have really replaced dolphins as the icon for saving the oceans. Almost all the royalties from Jaws later on, when Peter Benchley kind of realized what was going on and apologized, he straight up disavowed Jaws and apologized for writing it. But all of his royalties went to shark conservation close to the end. So, you know, I wonder if Jaws maybe didn't have more of a positive effect than a negative effect in the long run. In the short run, I mean, there was definitely a moment where people were out there just hauling sharks in and killing them, but they were doing that before Jaws too. And it's hard to tease those out. I think when you think about orcas had a very different cultural moment. People feared orcas for a long time too, especially the Inuit and the Macaw and the kind of native tribes that were on the Pacific coast of the United States and Canada. But because orcas didn't really occur in the same places that people were really populous, you know, the Atlantic seaboard had a huge population explosion in the 20th century, and there's a lot of sharks on the Atlantic seaboard. And there's a lot of, you know, if there's people here, the reality is if you swum in the ocean, you've swum with 20 or 30 sharks. They are.
Oh, Andrew, why did you just tell me that?
But think about how often you've been in the ocean and how rarely you've been attacked by sharks.
That's not going to help, Andrew. I'm sorry. that's not going to help. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's funny. Many, many years ago, before I knew what this was, I went on a date with a girl, and we went to this restaurant, and it was a kind of like a frou-frou place, and this was before I was a vegetarian as well, and they handed me this soup. I ordered it not knowing what it was, and they told me, oh, it's shark. And I was really horrified because even, you know, at the time, I was like, I feel bad for shark, you know? It's like,
yeah.
I mean, there was the whole thing about shark fin soup, which is this barbaric thing of cutting off fins of shark and then just leaving the poor thing to die in the water. I mean, you're not even killing the shark for the food. You're just maiming it. For the Senate. Now, is all that stuff illegal now because we were smarter about conservation, at least in this country?
It depends on where you are. And there's a lot of stuff in the shark conservation world that gets conflated with each other. So shark fin soup has been kind of this benchmark thing that people have been protesting about because finning is so cruel. So what you described is called finning, and that's because shark fins are enormously more valuable than the rest of the shark meat. And so some fishers will go out and they will, like you described, just cut off the fins and throw the carcasses, often alive, back in the water. Because you can store a lot more shark fins than you can store a bunch of whole shark carcasses.
Of course.
And the fins sell for a lot more than the rest of the body. It's an economic incentive for fishers. That has been banned in many, many, many countries. The import has been banned in a lot of places. But you can get shark fins by fishing for sharks and landing the whole shark. And
right.
then, there's this whole question of, well, if people are going to be fishing for sharks, then should they not then use the full shark and not discard things? And so there's been a little bit of pushback against, like, well, banning all shark fin is not necessarily the way to go. We should be looking to reform the entire fishing industry and making there be an incentive for people to not do this incredibly cruel, barbaric finning practice. And then, of course, there's a whole issue where sharks are pretty tremendously overfished in most fisheries, and so we really shouldn't necessarily be fishing sharks at all if the populations haven't recovered. And that's true in a lot of places, but not all places. There's a couple shark fisheries in the U.S. that are considered sustainable. I know some shark biologists that disagree with that status and some shark biologists that support it. So, that gets into the politics of things, and politics are enormously more complicated than ecology.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I'm guessing they want to do for it the way they've done it for ivory. Ivory's just flat out, you can't have ivory now, and no one wants to be involved with it other than really horrible people, because you know what's been done and you know what has to be done to the animal to get it, and it's just completely verboten, which, when I grew up, it was an accepted, I think, still kind of an accepted, you didn't think about that stuff, at least when I was younger. And then you get older and you're like, well, wait a minute, this came from a thing and it had to, So yeah, even though the shark in Jaws is this merciless killer that eats children and dogs, poor Pippet, although Steven Spielberg, smart, not showing the dog. The dog just disappears. That's bad enough, but nobody wants. I honestly don't know if I would be able to watch Jaws if Pippet got it on camera, because it would be so awful to watch.
Yeah.
I mean, I for some weird reason, I have less sympathy for the Kintner boy than I do the Pippet. But,
it's amazing how powerful those off-scene moments can be, because I think of, a recent Jaws-y movie, Jurassic World, I guess is the last one.
Yeah.
And they have that horrible scene where the assistant is picked up by the pteranodon.
God, yeah.
And you're watching, it's like, this isn't even entertaining anymore. If you just saw her get picked up by the pteranodons and never saw her again, that would have been such a powerful scene. But the way it is, you're just like, this is, I mean, you know, The word obscene comes from the Greek for off scene, and it's a theater term for moments of violence happen not on the stage, because you don't show that in theater, and you get a much more compelling scene when you kind of do it that way. Like, I'm fine with a little bit of ultra violence. Like, Deadpool was a fantastic movie, but it doesn't. The kinds of things they did in Jurassic World didn't really lend themselves to good filmmaking, really.
That scene is like a snuff film, what they did.
Yeah,
and she's not a bit, I know we're getting off topic, but, that character is not a bad character. She's not
no.
a bad person. And then we see her, get ripped apart by a succession of creatures, and the scene is done for laughs. And I was who does, what am I watching? What is this movie? I was like, yeah, that was... Really? Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing about Steven Spielberg, has an inherent sympathy for everyone who gets it in this movie, whether it's Chrissy Watkins, who gets it right in the beginning. I mean, the terror you feel of her in the very beginning of just being jerked around, and she's screaming and blah, 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 and you hear it and then silence. I mean, just silence. I mean, and then the Kintner boy, because you don't get a chance to grieve for the Kintner boy, but you do it through the mother, who,
right.
of course, has that wonderful scene with Chief Brody where she slaps him. And then, again, the Pippet, we never see what happens to Pippet. The poor, not the fisherman, but the guy in the boat that tries to rescue the Brody kids, and he gets literally dragged under the water. To watch that shark just under the surface fly underneath him, and then you see him get pulled down is just, again, nightmare inducing. I mean, and Spielberg really does have sympathy for all of his victims, which, again, for a movie that is meant to just scare the hell out of you, it has a real heart to it and a real soul that, again, I think is missing from the later movies and any other kind of movie like this, Orca or any of these other things. It has a real humanity to it.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. It's you don't see that a lot, especially now. You don't see that a lot in modern horror films and modern monster films.
People are sort of my pun is not intentional, but people are chum in these other movies, and here these are people, these are nice people, except for Mayor Vaughn, who you wouldn't mind seeing getting killed, who ironically is the one not going to get killed,
right?
I love that whole scene about where they talk about the I think she was caught up by a boat propeller. You know, you're like, oh, come on. You know what I mean? Like, and there, of course, I don't know if you ever saw, have you ever seen any of the Landshark sketches from Saturday Night Live in the
70s? Oh, yeah, those are, I love those.
And they have John Belushi playing Hooper, and he's looking at a body in a little bucket, and he says, oh, my God. He says, I can't believe anyone thinks this woman got killed by falling out of a tree. It's like the fantastic, you know, it was just like, yeah, it's, the thing is just so, oh, my God. I'm trying to, like, coalesce my thoughts about all the other great moments. I mean, again, of course, the line, you're going to need a bigger boat, part of the culture, and that was just created by Roy Scheider on the spot, apparently. And I have never learned, I've never gone back and read the Jaws script. I would love to know what the original line was. If that was an ad-lib by Roy Scheider, what was the line? Because clearly there's something that has to happen when he's chumming and the shark pops his head out and then he does that jerk back and he's got the cigarette dangling out of his mouth. Clearly there's a line there. I just don't know what that line is. But, I mean, I always wondered, like, what it must feel like to be somebody like Roy Scheider who, on the spur of a moment, created something that became part of the culture. Like, what an amazing – that's not something an actor typically thinks of doing. And, you know, I like to – the fact that – both Scheider and Dreyfuss years later would appear in these documentaries to be talk about the movie. Like, they were proud of it. Robert Shaw really didn't get to live too much longer past Jaws. Yeah. He died in 1979, I think, or 80. I don't think he really got the chance. But Scheider and Dreyfuss got to see, and Spielberg got to see what they created in this enduring movie. And it's kind of a nice thing that they, as Scheider, of course, is unfortunately no longer with us, but they got to live on and see, you know, wow, people really, you know, love this movie. And there's a documentary that comes with one of the versions of it, which apparently Spielberg is on it. And he talks about that Universal kept the boat on their lot for many years. And it got exposed to the sun and the wood cracked. And one day, some Universal suit just decided to get rid of it. They said, oh, chop it up. Just chop it up. And Spielberg apparently would see the boat from his office at random intervals. And one day he noticed it was gone and called the head of, you know, Universal's, carpentry crew and said, hey, where's the Orca? And they said, oh, yeah, we chopped it up. And Spielberg admits, he says, it was not fun being that guy that day. Because, I mean, that guy, he chewed the guy out. Because, I mean, imagine getting a phone call from Steven Spielberg. Where the hell? And the idea that the movie studio would not keep the boat from Jaws is just sort of – and it's like, I think movie studios nowadays, they don't make props anymore. It's all CGI. But yeah. I think if they make a prop, they kind of know to keep it at this point. Because it was like everyone wants something connected with Jaws. I mean, there are still tourists to this day who go to Amity – to visit the town, and of course the town dines out on it. Of course,
ironically, Jaws was great for Amity's tourism.
Yeah, I mean, everyone wants to go to Martha's Vineyard and hang out and see where they created this. So, is there anything else we? I mean, again, there's so much to say about Jaws, but I mean, at the expense of just sort of meandering here, or whatever. Is there anything else we want to talk about? What can people do if they want to learn more about, like, preservation of sharks or oceanography or just that kind of environmental bent of making our oceans, you know, our oceans are pretty damn important. Where can people go to find out more about this kind of stuff?
So there's a lot of great resources out there. Of course, Southern Fried Science, southernfriedscience.com. There are a ton of fantastic marine biologists and marine conservationists on Twitter that are always happy to talk about what they do. If you follow me or if you follow Why Sharks Matter or
that's David Alistair, Schiffman, right? David Schiffman.
David Schiffman, yeah. At Why Sharks Matter. Alistair Dove, who I think is at Alistair Dove. Craig McLean, who's at Dr. Craig MC. Kim Martini, who's at Rejected Banana. Any of these people, just go on Twitter, look for marine biologists, and there are so many of them. It's one of the most active of the science communities that do just engaged outreach. Deep Sea News is a great site. A lot of the NGOs like Oceana, Save Our Sharks, Pew has a ton of information out there. There are some great resources. There used to be a fantastic NGO called Upwell that still has some resources out there. So there's a ton of places online. You can go also find your local marine lab. There's a bunch of them all up and down the coast. If you're in a coastal state, if you're in Virginia, go to VIMS. They have a great visitor center, and there's always scientists hanging out that are happy to talk to you about things. Go to the National Aquarium in Baltimore. I think the D.C. Aquarium has been shuttered, but the National Zoo in D.C. has some exhibits. Monterey Bay Aquarium, one of the best in the world. There's, you know, it's a place to go. And then, of course, go to the beach. Grab yourself an Audubon guide to tide pools or a fish identification guide and go snorkeling. And, you know, the best way to learn about the ocean is to get in the water and see it for yourself. And if you see some sharks, that's great. Wave to them and say hi. They will totally leave you alone in 99.8% of the cases.
You'd like to prove that, right? Get your name in the National Geographic. I had to get that in. I was dying. It's one of my favorite lines. Mayor Vaughn, one of the great characters in all times movie. And, you know, how is it, just as we're wrapping up here, how is it that anger blazer is not something you can get from Universal or something? Everyone I know wants that. Because it's a real jacket.
I have looked for it. You can't, like, there's no, like, oh, man, I want that. It's so great. It's so perfect.
It's a real jacket. I mean, they bought it off of Martha's Vineyard, the prop department. Yeah. Just bought it. So, I mean, how is that not – you can get Jaws T-shirts. And, there, of course, there was the Jaws game from Ideal, which I had as a kid. Did you ever have that game where you take the crap out of the shark? Oh, I love the crap out of that game where you take all the junk out of the shark's mouth and it closes down on you.
Oh, I did play that one. Yeah.
Oh, I love that game. That's such a great game. I mean, it's like – but, I mean, how is Universal doesn't sell that anger blazer? I don't know, because I don't know anyone who doesn't love it. And unironically at this point, I mean, they just want that anchor blazer. It's just so perfect.
Yeah.
And so I think that's going to do it for Jaws. Like I said, I there's so much more I could say about it, but good Lord, it's just, you know, I really just kind of want to watch the movie again. I just watched it today in preparation again for this movie. I want to watch it again. So, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on, and I really appreciate it. This was something that, as much as I love Jaws, I wanted to springboard this into a discussion about sharks and everything else, because, like I said, as much as I love the movie, and I do love the movie, it's one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time, I never get tired of watching it. One of the local chains here shows it once a year. I go every year because I just don't get tired of it. It's Peter Benchley's Shark Trouble book means a lot to me as a nice bookend, and that this was a guy that cared so much about sharks. And as you said, he donated money, you know, all the proceeds. Everyone knows my favorite character is Aquaman. And, you know, it's like, there's a reason for that. It's because he, you know, he's the king of the 70% of the world. And, you know, I always find the oceans to be deeply mysterious and very scary. It's always been that way since I was a kid. And, you know, the idea that this movie is sort of like, it keeps me scared of water, but it also makes me want to embrace it and learn more about it and stuff. It's just, it does so much, and it's just such an enduring classic. So I really wanted to, if I was going to talk about it on the show, I really wanted to do something special, and you're made that come true. So I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I had a great time.
Awesome. So again, everybody, if you want to follow Andrew, go to Andrew, what's your Twitter handle? It's at Andrew David Thaler.
At S. Fried Scientist.
Oh, S. Fried Scientist. AndrewDavidThaler.com is the website, right?
AndrewDavidThaler.org is my .org. Online resume. But okay. The main website will be Southern Fried Science.
Southern Fried Science. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So, again, thanks so much for doing the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you want to comment, of course, you can go to the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com, and you can send us a message there, or you can leave a comment on the individual show threads, or you can follow the show over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So, again, Andrew, thanks so much. I really had a great time. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and until next week, That's a wrap.
Larry, Larry, if we make an effort today, we might be able to save August.
August? For Christ's sake, tomorrow's the 4th of July, and we will be open for business. It's going to be one of the best summers we've ever had. Now, if you fellas are concerned about the beaches, you do whatever you have to make them safe. But those beaches will be open for this weekend.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water... The shark is here. The ferociously good ice pop from Good Humor. The Good Humor shark has the great taste of natural grape and a shocking shark shape.
Mmm, delicious.
The Good Humor shark is waiting for you in your supermarket freezer.